the subject as you see it, the media and the church dealing with the press. And we'll go down the list here, first of all, with the panelists as they are listed in order. Each one of them will make a 10 to 15 minute presentation, and then we'll open it to your questions and comments. So let's begin with David Forsyth, who's the New York Region Public Communications Representative for the Church and Vice President of McGraw-Hill Book Company. Dave?
I knew it was going to happen this way. What a tough act to follow after that last one. I bring you greetings from the Big Apple, but I really have to make one thing perfectly clear before any of you buttonhole me with another manuscript. I am not with the McGraw-Hill Book Company, program introduction notwithstanding. I am with the McGraw-Hill Publications Company, and we publish about 30 magazines, including Business Week. I'm sorry, I don't handle the manuscripts. But along with my duties as an officer with the Publications Company, I'm responsible for survey research. Mall intercept is a type of interviewing, and you're all acquainted with it. You go into a mall, and a person with a questionnaire stops you and asks you some questions. There's the story of the particular interviewer stopping a person and with the question, "What is the world's greatest invention?" The first person asked, thought for a minute, and said, "Well, it's got to be the wheel," and waxed eloquently on the reasons why. The second one thought and said, "Well, it's got to be the internal combustion engine," and described as to the reasons for that. The third one asked the question, this one with a little longer hair than the other two, thought for a minute and said, "Well, it's got to be the thermos bottle." The interviewer, mystified, said, "Well, why did you say that?" The respondent said, "Well, just think about it a moment. When it's summer and it's hot, you take a cool liquid and you put it into that thermos bottle and it keeps it cold." "Yeah." "And when it's in the heat of the cold of the summer," did I get that right? Okay, let's get it straight. When it's summer, you put a cool liquid into it. When it's winter, you put things like Perol, you put chocolate, you put Postum, and so on. And it keeps it hot. "Well, what's so strange about this?" the interviewer asked. Well, the interviewer respondent replied, "How does the thermos bottle know?" Now, that brings me to the focus of my presentation today. Number one, how do people know about the church? Number two, how do we multiply our messages? Now let me pose a problem by sharing a couple of items with you. A year or so ago, our local Mormon congregation in New Jersey had an opportunity to become active in a local community event. The Presbyterian minister, whose church was just celebrating its 100th year in that particular community, came to us and asked us why we were getting involved. Up to then, he was not particularly aware of our presence. He didn't know of any interest that we had in the community, and he wondered why we were now intent on visibility. Number one. Number two, there's a bi-region part of the church in the New York, New Jersey area. It consists of six stakes, about 55 units, branch and ward units. It covers Manhattan and Long Island and Staten Island and part of New York, a little bit up into Connecticut and Westchester, and then three stakes over on the North Jersey side. In exercising my church calling to work with these people, I counted them the other day, the ones that were responsible for getting to understand the gospel, and there are 22 million people in these six states. Now, Keeping in mind the familiar admonition to all Mormons, every Mormon a missionary, that is, if we use the personal rather than the non-personal approach, we have about 20,000 members responsible for contacting these 22 million people. And I figured that's about one for every 1,000. And went to the mission president and found out he's got 200 missionaries in that area, which means that there's 100,000 people for every one missionary. Now, whether or not you agree with the dictum that faithful members generally accept, that a major function of the church is to teach the gospel to all the world, or as Joseph Smith emphasized in Section 1 of the Doctrine and Covenants, one purpose is to bring the church forth out of obscurity and out of darkness. So consequently, those in priesthood lines of authority understand that the premise that these 22 million people in the New York metropolitan area have got to be exposed and be given the opportunity to become aware of the church. Now, those of you that live here in the valley and those high percentages of you that are members of the church, this isn't too meaningful, but think about the problem that we have. And the question, of course, to us is, how do we accomplish this enormous task? Now, a number of my good friends, and several of them that are here today, has suggested to me that those 22 million people do not have to be communicated to by the church at all. Rather, any goodness which percolates from a religion should boil over and perpetuate itself. In a sense, they say, we should be known for what we do without having to tell anybody about it. Further, it is felt that outsiders will learn of the church through natural means, that word of mouth truly is the Christian way, that public communications are really not required. But then again, I ask the question, how are thousands influenced by just one, especially if that one does not say anything? Now, despite the well-meaning advice of some of us here, we in the East prefer to heed the admonition of Spencer Kimball, the Mormon prophet, and multiply our message. He said it to us, when we have used the satellite and related discoveries to their greatest potential, and all of the media, the papers, the magazines, the television, the radio, all in their greatest power, then and not until then shall we approach the insistence of our Lord and Master to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. So we in Church Communications in New York attempt to build bridges with and obtain coverage in, and let me tell you how many newspapers. In this New York six-state area, 456 newspapers. Radio stations, 150 different radio stations, at least a dozen television stations, and scores of cable outlets. Well, we can work with these people, but our professional counterparts here in headquarters in Salt Lake assist with TV programs, with films, with home front public service announcements, magazine articles, and yes, horror of horrors, even advertisements in Reader's Digest. But the charge is being leveled with increasing crescendo that all of this that we're trying to do smacks of Huskerism, of media manipulation, of subliminal advertising, of the marks of the electronic church, of that most crass of commercial words, they're using marketing. And I have to agree, in its most absurd sense, communications to the public can be labeled manipulation. Yet it simply depends, when you think about it, on whom is doing the communicating or the manipulating, and who is defining the terms. For example, a number of years ago, a good friend of mine, Peggy Fletcher, and several friends came up with a brilliant concept. why not start a publication to share ideas with a greater number of like believers? Broaden the circle, as it were. The principle was embraced to share efficiently the ideas with others. In other words, the message had to be multiplied. So, through the use of basic promotional techniques, circulation grew and Sunstone continued to expand and spread its influence even further. A symposium was implemented, and believe it or not, marketing tools such as direct mail and brochures and flyers and even advertisements were utilized. The point is, you see, whenever any of us espouse a cause, whether it be intellectual, political, spiritual, or even to sell soap, it is only natural that we want to multiply our message. In fact, those of us here at the symposium desiring to have McGraw-Hill Book Company publish our manuscripts are utilizing this concept. We're just using different words to describe the communications principle in marketing our words and selling the books to intended audiences. We might decry on one side the church telling about itself in Reader's Digest advertisements, but at the same time we implore McGraw-Hill to pay for advertisements to promote our books, to multiply our messages, if you will. I guess it boils down to this. Anyone who has an idea to communicate must follow an informational or marketing procedure. You must determine who is most likely to buy your book, who is most likely to subscribe to Sunstone, or who is most likely to listen to gospel principles. Thus, whether you like it or not, you are putting together demographics, you are identifying an audience, you are trying to target that audience to the best prospects. All right? You've got to describe these potential users. Then, you have to move your target audience up the communications ladder, or sometimes we call it the steps to a sale ladder, where we move people from unawareness, no matter the concept we're trying to put across, to awareness. From awareness up the next step to perception, from perception up to an understanding, and then finally to motivation, to buying our book, to attending the Sunstone Symposium, or possibly attending the Mormon Church. In short, we are attempting to build bridges to the media in the New York, New Jersey area to these 456 different newspapers, 150 radio stations, TV, cable outlets. This is how we are multiplying the church's message. And in truth, it is not much different from how all of you here multiply your messages. Thank you very much.
To a reporter, one of the marks of a good public relations or public communications representative is one who will help you grease the skids to get the information that you need. A bad public relations representative is the one who tries to throw roadblocks in your way. The Church Public Communications Office has always been very helpful to me as a reporter, and certainly Paul Cummings in his position as a public communication representative at BYU has been just as helpful. Paul is editor of BYU Today and a public communications representative for Brigham Young University. Paul?
Thanks, Roy. I need to lay a little background. I'm a journalist by training. I wasn't trained as a public relations representative. In fact, Paul Swenson and I worked on the Deseret News. I remember doing investigative work on exposing unethical sewing machine sales practices in the area, which was an interesting situation. I've worked in San Diego on the San Diego Union. I worked for the Deseret News and the Tribune, and I've worked in magazine work. In fact, worked for Paul's boss on a group of industrial publications, Bob Coles, for several years. I went into the news bureau business at BYU because I saw a need that I perceived from my training, a need for honesty. And I think here's a key point that I need to bring out. And let me lay a little more background first. This is titled The Media and the Church, and I don't purport to represent the church, but I do represent BYU and have to be on the hot seat from time to time, and many of our problems come because we are a church-sponsored university. The University of Utah doesn't have to deal with Boy George. The University of Utah would not have to worry about a Seventh East Press situation. University of Utah, as some of my superiors point out, and they cannot understand this, and what I want to lay out here is I see things from both sides. I'm considered an enemy by both sides in a way. I'm a flack as seen in the eyes of the press, and I represent the press or the media. Roy's pointed out the difference in the meanings there in another forum, but anyway, I'm viewed as the enemy in my own circles. It's like being a double agent in a way, if you can understand what I mean. I have a hard time convincing my people about how the media works. I get this kind of a feeling, well, why don't we just tell them all the good things about BYU and publish some standard statements and ethics statements, and then when something bad happens, they'll treat us nice. And we can't understand why the University of Utah gets so much good publicity. Of course, they're talking about the artificial heart transplant, which is a natural, goes worldwide. And then they contrast that with a Boy George, which is a natural, goes worldwide. Literally, goes worldwide. We got a clipping service, and I think we spent over $500. Normally, I'll cut it off if something gets really hot, but I wanted to let this one run. And we spent over $500 paying for clippings coming in from all over the world on the Boy George situation. Well, then they come down on me and say, well, you know, what's the trouble here? Why can't we get good publicity? When in reality, we do. I do really believe we do. It doesn't show up, though, as much as some things like Boy George. So it's a double agent kind of a situation. I agree that the church and BYU need to tell a message. The problem comes now in this. The church has been hammered for so many years by the media. And if you go back into the 1800s, you find all kinds of political cartoons that the church had virtually no means of defending itself against. There were a number of papers that were started back then to try to counter that. The church came through some very difficult times, having people jab them, poke them, hammer on them, and at the same time came through some times where leaders in the church had relatives, close friends, associates that were actually killed by mobs, so it wasn't funny business for them. The church got into a fortress mentality, I think. And I'm telling you this as an extension of my experience at BYU. And as a result, really wanted to stay out here in the valley and stay by itself. And then all of a sudden it discovered this wonderful Big Apple kind of a syndrome. Let's tell the world our message. And that's admirable. That's good. I have to frankly say, though, that I don't think they have dealt with the other side of the coin, and that is, once you open the door and start telling the message, it's the nature of journalists to start asking other questions. And we fight this all the time. Somebody will come to me and say, let's put out a news release and make a statement about this particular thing. And I humor them, and I put out a news release. I mean, we work on this. I mean, we'll put it through committee, and you know how hard it is to get things through committee. And we'll get this thing detailed right down to the core, knowing all the time that once we put it out, I'm still going to have to answer questions. But there is this attitude, I think, that we want to show the positive side. We don't want to deal with the negative. We just went through the session on humor. I always liken it to the Jews. I think the Jews have a good way of looking at themselves and laughing at themselves, and I don't think we've come to that point yet. I think we're oversensitive in many issues. I know if I see something about the Catholic Church, I don't sit and wring my hands and say, aha, they are on the skids, they are going downhill, they are falling apart. I view that as a part of life. It's part of what we are. The same for the Southern Baptists or any other organization. But I don't get that reaction when something about the Mormons. We are ready to jump into the fray with all fours swinging when somebody like a Ken Woodward in New York is just doing his job and explaining how he perceives Mormons. And that's where we have a problem, because we don't always want to be perceived that way. And rather than saying, well, what does he mean by that? We turn around and say, no, that isn't true. No, well, that just is, they're out to get us. You see, we're still suffering from this fortress mentality. We're paranoid in a way, and we say they're out to get us. I think someday, and it will come, we're going to have to let the church and the gospel be the strength that it is, and let it stand for itself, and understand that we're all human, and that there are going to be good and bad in all of these things, but the good is going to prevail, ultimately. So we've got a sort of a double-bind situation here, trying to do something positively and get the message out, at the same time trying to counter by saying nothing about the negatives. And we're going to have to deal with the negatives if we want to take advantage of the powerful media in the world and get our message out the way we would like to have it done. At BYU, let me point out a couple of things. I see a great deal in my position of ignorance on the part of the people I represent, and yes, on the part of the media. And I've been in both, I've seen both from inside. And you need to understand, I think, a little bit, now that I've said the church is afraid to say anything, and you come to them and say, well, just tell the truth. Tell the truth. Let's just say what the truth is on this thing. And yet, can you really tell the truth when you have a Shelby Strother, say, from the Denver Post, or a Peter Bart for Rolling Stone, who come in, and Shelby, I know when he came, he just acted like a born-again Christian. I mean, he was talking about, oh, this is a wonderful place. I think he thought he had to do that to get any information out of us. You recall, he's the one that said that he couldn't get an appointment with anybody at the church. All he was doing was responding to John Aloysius Farrell's prior difficulty in getting an appointment with the church. He just didn't even try, or didn't try very hard. Anyway, he came on like a born-again Christian, like, this is a wonderful place, everybody's great. And then he proceeded to get interviews, and we set him up, and I would have done the same for anybody. That's my philosophy, is to help wherever you can. And then he wrote a very, for those of you who've seen the article, a very inaccurate article about blacks in Utah. You have to understand he's a sports writer. Anyway, how do you convince your boss that he ought to go for that interview, that he ought to talk to the media, when he doesn't know if he's going to get snookered in the process? And nine times out of ten, when the media come to us, it's for a controversial issue. I mean, they don't just waltz down there to Provo and say, gee, you've got a nice thing here, let me do it. That does happen, but not often. Usually they're out for something. And then we get a Shelby Strother or a Peter Bart or some others that we've had that I don't consider represent the media very well. And that's the only contact our supervisors or our people have. It's difficult to say, yes, grant an interview. It's sort of like telling your boss that he needs a haircut when he really doesn't, or he doesn't think he does, and he's supposed to go to, what's the name, the Sweeney Todd, you've seen that play, Sweeney Todd, the butcher barber of Fleet Street, the man that would have people in to cut their hair and then end up chopping them up for liver and selling them. It's sort of like that, like, just lie down here on the track or lie down here in the middle of the street and let these people run over you. And that is extended, I think, to the church, more so than at BYU, because people are always in there pushing, trying to get something on the church. And because of our incongruities, we say we are the chosen people, the perfect people, God's elect. You will always have people that are looking for the exception to that. And that's what makes news. That's what makes news of BYU or anywhere else, is that exception, that incongruity. So how do you get our people to be more comfortable with the media when the media don't always represent themselves well? We've had, and I need to put the other foot down and say we've had some very good dealings with some exceptional journalists, and I could name a number here in the area and from national media. So I'm not throwing stones at the media per se. I'm just saying that there's enough misrepresentation that it's very difficult to get a well-meaning group of other people to say, we're going to be open about all of this. I can remember when Ernest Wilkinson was at BYU, it came time for his retirement, and he told this publicly and was proud of it. I was not there at the time and wouldn't have been had I had a choice. He told this publicly that he was called the morning of his announcement by a member of the press, got him out of bed, and he was asked if he was going to retire. I don't know the exact wording, but he said, no, I'm not going to retire. And then in the announcement that afternoon, he proceeded to say, I was called and asked by a member of the media if I were going to retire, and I said, no, I'm not going to retire, I'm going to resign. Now, that kind of, it was nice for him, he's an attorney. And maybe that's why attorneys and media people are at the bottom of the list in terms of prestige or trust in the world. He was an attorney, and then he showed how he was very, very clever in tricking the media. Well, then can you blame the media for turning around and being tricky in doing what they need to do? And somehow we don't understand that the media have their job to do, and they're not always out to get us. They're just doing a job, basically. And if they don't do it exactly the way we want it, we get upset. I have to contrast that with Dallin Oaks, who ran up against a situation where somebody at BYU lost a container of nuclear material, and this is one of those things that had to be registered with the government, and when the government came to they have to come every year and check it. It was used for scientific experimentation. Couldn't find it anywhere. And people started looking around, and it's a one-ton steel container with safety locks and all kinds of things, and this material was stored inside of it and couldn't find it anywhere. And finally somebody found it down at the local dump. You know, somebody had seen it, said, well, let's get rid of this thing, and took it down there. Well, we were subject to a several $1,000 fine, and I think under a prior administration the answer would have been, well, let's not say anything about this. But Dallin Oaks gave out full information on that whole incident, and as a result, there wasn't a big fuss about it. But if it had looked like we were trying to cover up and somebody had found it out, it would have been made a great deal of mush about it. All I'm saying is I personally believe in honesty and in candidness. I believe in understanding how the media work without seeing a witch behind every bush. And I plead for an understanding of the media to help us get our people so that they can understand that there is great value in honesty and in speaking out and playing. If you're going to talk about the good, let's answer questions about the bad as well. So often I get, I'll cite one other example, it's a recent example. I think you're aware that Baylor University has a Mormon professor, Spanish, who is being challenged, not by the university, keep this in mind, not by the university, but some of the, I don't know what they call them, their conference people or whatever, one of the influential Baptist members who is saying we should not have a Mormon teaching at Baylor University, at a Southern Baptist university. We were called by the media, and the Houston Chronicle, by the way, has done a very good job on this. They called us and wanted to know how many people do we have who are members of another faith that are not Mormons teaching at BYU. And the initial response, as I started to do research on that, is, well, we're just not going to say things. Why do we have to say that? Well, because I think we ought to be honest about it. We ought to let people know. And so they said, fine, you can tell them that, but don't give them any names. We don't want anybody's name out. And I can understand that. If a professor is a member of another faith and she or he does not want to be quoted, we would not do that. Anyway, it turns out we have about 40 people on the faculty that are members of other faiths, including Jews, Southern Baptists, Catholics, Protestants, Sikhs, any number of things. 40 of them, I think it represents about 25 different faiths. And we were told not to release any names. Well, of course, the writer from the Houston Chronicle wanted to have a name, and finally I said, I'll see what I can do. And I called one of these Southern Baptist professors, and I said, how do you feel about this? Would you be willing to? And with his full consent, I gave his name to the Houston paper. And that turned out to be a very positive story. But you see, the initial response is, don't say anything. Don't do anything. This may not be positive. And that's where we need help. So my plea is to have help from the media and help from the church membership and help from our administrators to understand both sides of this fence. It's a plea for honesty and openness, which is not by any means attainable very easily. We are always going to have problems in this area. They'll never go away. But I think we're getting a degree of sophistication in knowing how to deal with it without a knee-jerk, paranoid reaction every time something comes along. And that's what we need to have. Thank you.
If I may use something that you said, Paul, to introduce our next panelist, how do you make the media comfortable, or how do you make the BYU comfortable with the media? How do you make the church comfortable with Paul Swenson? Paul is the editor of Utah Holiday. I have to admire him because he digs for a lot of things that need to be said, and he says them, I'm sure, in the face of a lot of criticism. Paul?
I think it was about a year and a half ago that I had a conversation with Paul Richards in a hallway at Utah Holiday magazine. And we talked about the time that we used to be reporters of the Deseret News and about where our professional lives had taken us and that sort of thing. And after we had the conversation, I got thinking about Paul Richards being down at BYU. And I thought, here's a person that is open-minded, a probing, honest, open individual with instincts for attempting to tell the truth and tell people in the best and clearest way what he believes, all those repertorial instincts that were developed over years as a reporter. And I got to thinking, how is Paul Richards going to survive down at BYU as a public relations person? And I thought, well, you know, I may be wrong about that, because not only has he survived, he seemed to thrive on it. He seems happy. He's relaxed. He's not nervous. He's not uptight. He is not defensive. And I thought I may need to reassess my whole feeling about church public relations work and BYU and everything else, because I don't know that I'd wish the job of public relations man for the church on anybody, let alone somebody as nice as Paul Richards. And within the year, I had occasion to think of Paul Richards many times, because During that year, I think the 7th East Press situation developed. Questions about BYU professors' participation in this conference. The Boy George incident occurred, and I read Paul responding to some of those incidents quoted in the paper, and I thought again of Paul Richards, and I felt some pain, and I also felt some tremendous I suppose good fortune and also good planning that somebody like Paul Richards was down there answering those questions. And then I thought about whether Paul Richards should be answering those questions, and it occurred to me that I didn't see Jeff Holland quoted extensively on any of those issues. And on the other hand, as I thought about it, I thought, would I want to see Jeff Holland quoted on those issues rather than Paul Richards? And I wasn't so sure I would. And then I thought about the public relations representatives for the church here in Salt Lake City and our dealings with them at Utah Holiday Magazine. And another memory occurred to me, and that was that a few years ago, a Norwegian filmmaker was here in Salt Lake City, and he made a documentary about the LDS Church, and he interviewed a whole bunch of people. This was for showing on public television in Scandinavia, particularly in Norway, as I recall. And he interviewed apostles, he interviewed virtually everybody, and I could tell that because he eventually interviewed me. And I couldn't remember what I said during that interview. When later I saw him about a year ago, and he said it's about to appear on a year later, and he said it was about to appear on TV. I couldn't remember at all what we had talked about, and what I had said, and I was worried about what I had said, and I was even more worried a little later when a public relations representative of the church called me up and said we've got a tape of film that was made in Norway and thought you might want to come and look at it. And I couldn't imagine why he would want me to do that. So I went over there to the church office building, and this, by the way, is a public relations representative who has since left that job and gone on to another career. But I was invited in, and he and I were the only ones huge room in which there were a couple of video receivers, and he turned on the tape, and about two-thirds of the way through, there I was saying something very innocuous about the church missionary program, saying how I enjoyed being on my mission and that sort of thing, and I was amazed that I said that. And after it was over, and he turned it off, and he bent towards me in kind of a confidential manner, and as I recall, he even whispered, and we were alone in this room, and I couldn't understand. And he said, the brethren are going to be very happy to see that that you said that, that I had nothing to say. I didn't know what to say, but it occurred to me that public relations representatives of the church are in an extremely precarious position, because they're out there not as official representatives per se. They are not ecclesiastical spokespeople for the church, and yet they're in many ways called to do to fill in that kind of capacity, and to somehow reach members of the media and have some kind of positive effect, and to, as Paul Richards said, be on the hot seat, respond to questions that take enormous preparation and enormous thinking through, just to be able to come to grips with. And I think then that when things go wrong, and when reporters or journalists don't get what they think they may need or that they think they ought to have, the frustration that boils over also boils over very often against the public relations people and those representatives. And part of that frustration is that They may feel that there's still a veil they can't pierce, that they can't get through, and that veil is often to get through to the actual ecclesiastical authorities of the church who seldom grant interviews, do occasionally for certain journalists. Outside journalists, that is, journalists coming in to Salt Lake City from outside, have somewhat of an advantage, possibly because there is the assumption that they will reach a larger audience with what they write, either pro or con, and therefore perhaps should have special consideration in having general authorities available to talk to them. However, part of the problem, I think, has to do with representatives of the local media, and that is that it's become very easy to live in this community and report the news in this community. And then when bumping up against the LDS Church, which occurs fairly often because of the influence of the church in this community, to apply a slightly different standard to how the church is covered, and to perhaps not ask embarrassing questions, and to not ask tough questions, maybe not because you don't think those questions can be answered, but because your tendency is that you don't want to embarrass ecclesiastical authorities of a church that you may belong to as a reporter. When Utah Holiday Magazine started 13 years ago and eventually began getting into community issues and issues that affect the people who live here, controversial things, immediately arose the question, how do you treat the LDS Church? Do you treat it as a special entity, aside from any other institution in this community, or do you treat it as any other news-making organization, which implies both the ability to question, to probe, to ask, which also by doing that, I think, implies some respect for that institution. If you're not going to ask tough questions of people, of individuals, of institutions, You may be giving the impression that you're shying away from dealing with substantive issues because you may not wholly believe that those issues can be settled. Therefore, the decision was made to attempt to treat the church in a respectful manner, as with any other newsmaking organization, and deal with the church as you would other institutions, and attempt to ask the questions that need to be asked to settle, or at least attempt to interpret and report community issues that affect us all. I think there's been some progress made in that area, and I think the church to some degree has responded in ways that suggest that they would like there to be more dialogue. And yet at times I despair about how I see community issues handled here. When a question is raised, I believe it was in a letters to the editor column of one of the newspapers, about Mormon conscientious objectors, immediately we get an answer from Don LaFever of the Church LDS Public Communications Office that unfortunately portrays the Mormon position on that issue in a much more Neanderthal light than it deserves to be presented. And somehow nobody comes to clear it up. And a lot of questions about that remain. Luckily, this conference and others address it, but I despair about the fact that somehow those issues are settled far too often in an unsatisfactory way between the public and public relations representatives, who are trying their best to give their version of what they believe is a church position, but often the veil remains, and we do not get the direct dialogue between the authorities of the church and the people who may be asking, the reporters, as well as the readers who are asking. Of course, that's true of any large corporation. That's true of any large institution, that the instinct is to draw in, the instinct is to designate a man over here who will answer the sticky stuff and not face it directly yourself. I'm not saying that in many ways, if church authorities took time to answer press questions, they might end up doing nothing but that. However, it seems to me that there could be some sharing of that role, so that we're not always putting the onus of the responsibility of explaining the church to the world on the shoulders of public relations representatives who are often, as I said before, in a job that is probably as close to hell as anything can be on this earth. I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Our last panelist, Lynn Packer, is one who does a delicate balancing act, I think. Difficult, at any rate. He is a reporter for KSL Television here in Salt Lake City and has been for some years. But he also teaches radio and television news at Brigham Young University. Not only does he have to commute 45 miles each way to work for both of them, but the philosophies, I think, seem a little different. KSL, on the one hand, is trying to get rid of that image of being the mouthpiece of the church. I don't think BYU is trying to do that. Lynn Packer.
First, I'd like to give you some perspective about my affiliation with KSL and BYU. KSL Television News enjoys a reputation not only as the best television news operation in the state, but also as one of the best in the United States. BYU's broadcast journalism program not only is clearly the best in Utah, it also ranks as one of the best in the United States, and Roy may want to debate that later. It is to the credit of the Mormon Church that these two institutions linked with broadcast journalism have attained such status. Now, any views I express this afternoon are not mine, or not mine. I could answer that truthfully. They're not mine, they're my wife's. She read through my presentation. She said, don't say anything controversial. But they are mine. And they're not those of BYU administrators or KSL managers. Indeed, I think my views are likely different because I'm liberal in my journalistic philosophy in a state where the mainstream of journalism thought, it's among all the reporters for all the media, is relatively conservative. It should be no surprise that the opinions of working reporters often clash with those of their upper management. Many managers tend to be conservative in their political views and are likely Republicans. Many television station managers come out of the sales ranks where their orientation was advertising and not journalism. National surveys show most reporters politically are Democrats. Not only is the average reporter likely more liberal than the average station manager, he's also likely more liberal than the average man on the street he's reporting for. You say, well, why is that? Perhaps one reason is that the American tradition of journalism is a liberal tradition. It seems kind of contradictory using liberal and tradition in the same breath. Nevertheless, traditional journalism in America is based on the idea that not only the elite in society, but also the masses should be able to be informed. Under the American tradition of journalism, the news media serve as watchdog over society's powerful people and institutions. That's an idea that's very foreign to non-democratic governments and non-democratic institutions. Government gets the most press scrutiny, and it should. But the more liberal a person's journalistic views, the greater the watchdog role he believes the press should play over other institutions, such as business, labor, science, religion, and so on. Now, most of you are news consumers. The philosophies held by reporters and our superiors have a lot to do with what information you get and what information you don't get, whether a story concerns the government, a business, or a religious organization. Most managers and reporters agree there are certain news stories or facts within those stories that should be voluntarily suppressed. For example, facts about Allied troop movements during wartime, or details about a murder that are too for a general audience. But generally speaking, the more liberal the journalist's news philosophy, the narrower the range of potential news stories or details that should be voluntarily censored. Here's an example of a fact I voluntarily left out of a story just recently. I was covering the lawsuit between 71 Utahns and a lending institution that loaned them money to invest in the now-defunct APCO Development Corporation. During the trial, I learned through a source that one of the jurors was a suspected potential target of a dissident Mormon murder suspect. The suspect was at large, and the juror moved his family into hiding. Until the suspect was found and jailed, we withheld reporting the story about increased security at the courtroom. A lot of potential stories fall into a gray area where there's conflict as to whether to suppress. So how do you handle potential news stories that might injure or upset certain people or interest groups? Or even as tough, how do you handle certain stories that will injure or upset one segment of society if the particular story does air, while at the same time it will injure or upset another segment of society if it does not air? Again, the two journalistic philosophies compete. When dealing with gray area stories or facts, the conservative journalist will say this: it might be a mistake to run the story, and it might be a mistake to not run the story, because I am not certain it is best to err on the side of non-disclosure. The liberal journalist will also concede it might be a mistake to broadcast the story, but unlike his conservative counterpart, he will say, if I am to err, it is best to err on the side of disclosure. Here, the liberal view is the traditional American journalism view. Even though certain stories can and do have negative consequences, the American tradition is that the greater good is served by a free flow of information to the public, to a maximum extent reasonable and legal. Here's a non-journalism example you parents might identify with. How much do we tell our children about sex? A liberal disclosure policy might fail. We might teach our children how to do the very thing we don't want them to do. A conservative policy might fail. Our kids might experiment because of curiosity or get erroneous information from other sources. A liberal parent will err on the side of talking about sex. A conservative parent will err on the side of keeping quiet. Historians face the same dilemma as journalists and parents. Say you're a church historian and you discover some fact or story that might change the public's perception of a historical, religious figure or event. Do you disclose or suppress?
Wildcat. And in another, a meek Mormon, obviously on the carpet before a scowling boss, hears the words, "No success in the home can compensate for losing the mega corporation account." My favorite, penned for the BYU Universe, is of a young man dazed and bleeding, arising from a pile of stones which have obviously been tossed at him, saying to the approaching BYU policeman, "All I said was, let him who is without sin cast the first stone." Grondahl's cartoons and Card's definitions, with their undercutting jabs at smugness, self-righteousness, officiousness, over-concern about non-essentials, and hypocrisy, go further than any Mormon humor I'm aware of in testing Wilson's and Oering's point about the necessity for emotional distance from the subject. I find myself variously amused and mightily uncomfortable at times in reading both of them. I believe then that Dr. Wilson's right when he insists that Mormon humor is a serious matter. Twain again said it well when he insisted humor was like the screw on an opera glass. It helps us to adjust our focus. Humor is therapeutic. It can be that safety valve of which he spoke, particularly in a tight and demanding society directed by a strong hierarchy of leaders, some of whom say we should beware of humor. Humor in the church, if it is kept in balance and if our faith is vibrant, can help church members to live in better harmony with themselves and their ideals. And by enabling us to flex and grow, to assert ourselves without threatening our standing in the church, can help us to deal with our leaders and doctrines without shattering or breaking, and thereby enable us to lessen the tension and the incongruity between ourselves and our faith and the church which houses our faith. I watched this at work on a brother high priest and his high priest group a few years ago. Because of a healthy sense of humor, the late Raymond Taylor, brother to Sam, and like Sam, a bit of a rebel, and like Sam, grandson of John Taylor, could sit unthreatened in his high priest group in the Provo Ninth Ward and tell in my presence as a stake leader how the Lord had blessed him. "Damn it, brethren," he said that morning, "the Lord's watching over us. I was called out last Wednesday evening and told the Allen building was burning down. The adjacent building where I have my office would probably go up in flames, and that I ought to get down there fast. I ran down, but they wouldn't let me in. I told them all my life's work was in that office, that I had to go get it."
The ideal is that we should tell the truth and suffer consequences. But realistically, truth is not often the major factor, and occasionally not a factor at all in deciding what news is published, in deciding what we tell our children, and in deciding what information gets into church history books and lesson manuals. Now some remarks more directly aimed at the theme of this session, the media and the church. Generally speaking, the Utah news media do not perform a watchdog role over the administration of the Mormon church. It's more of an observation role. At times it's firm, but never really tough. Perhaps a couple of reasons for that. First, Utah reporters tend to be more conservative than the mainstream of American reporters. Thus, we are less philosophically inclined to even believe we should play a watchdog role over a non-government institution. Second, the nature of Utah's unique media ownership and audience relationship. Utah's number one television station, KSL, and number two newspaper, the Deseret News, are owned by the Mormon Church. Thus, restraint with gray area sensitive stories is built in for these two media. So what about the non-church-owned media in Utah? Well, they know how their bread gets buttered. Their audience is more than 70% LDS. While the ownership of Utah's number one newspaper, number two television station, may not be pro-Mormon, and most of them are non-Mormon, it is yet in their best interest financially to not offend the Mormon majority audience. There is a direct correlation between circulation, ratings, and profits. Thus, restraint with stories sensitive to Mormons is a matter of economics. The result, the Utah media do not treat top LDS administrators the same way they treat top government administrators. That despite the fact the church in Utah may at times have more influence on the lives of residents, Mormons and non-Mormons alike, than state government. The distance now maintained between top church officials and reporters is much greater than the distance maintained between reporters and government officials. Church press conferences with general authorities conducting are rare. This gap between church officials and reporters has widened over the years. Before he retired, Tribune reporter Scoop Williams would tell us younger reporters about the years he covered the church office beat for the old Telegram. He says he had direct access to Heber J. Grant, George Albert Smith, and David O. McKay. Scoop says he once suggested to Elder Gordon B. Hinckley that the church create a public relations office to stop the unfair advantage the Deseret News had over the Telegram and Tribune. I think the gap between reporters and church authorities is for complex reasons, some of which I've mentioned. I sense a great deal of distrust toward the news media, as both Pauls have pointed out, on the part of some church leaders. Some of that for good reason. There have been stories done in the national press about Mormonism that have been unduly inaccurate and biased. And one of those I had in mind is the one that Paul Richards told you about. Although media access to church leaders is restricted, it is not denied. 3 years ago, I did a story about LeGrand Richards' 95th birthday. He granted what was a delightful interview. Last year, while covering the July 24th parade, President Hinckley cordially responded to reporter questions as we ran alongside of his car. It's very clear. It was in the parade. It's very clear that the coverage gap is not there because reporters are barred outright from contact. Whether acting on Scoop Williams' suggestions or not, the church did create a PR department. That's another reason for the news reporter church leader gap. There's a middleman there now. Church public relations personnel now have the lion's share of day-to-day contact with the press. I found them to be helpful in dealing with both positive and negative stories. Their role, of course, as Paul pointed out, is to promote positive stories and minimize the impact of negative ones. That role is made much easier by the fact the media rarely bare their fangs at the church, instead usually only reacting to church involvement stories that pop up from time to time. At present in Utah, there are two major running stories that involve the Mormon church on the perimeter. The first involves promoter Grant Affleck, whose trial for criminal fraud begins in 4 days. Affleck used a sales approach that directly appealed to Mormon investors, an appeal heightened by the fact that Mormon general authority Paul Dunn was on Affleck's advisory board, a fact prominently mentioned in Affleck's missionary-like flip chart sales presentation. Hundreds of Utahns lost millions in the fraud scheme. The other story, which continues to unfold, is about the slaying of an American Fork mother and her infant daughter. The two were allegedly slain by an apostate Mormon who claimed he was acting for God when he slit their throats. Although I think neither story has been thoroughly covered, I think KSL Television has done the best job reporting the Affleck controversy, and the Deseret News the best job reporting on the American Fork killings, despite the fact that they're pro-Mormon, owned by Mormon media. Both stories relate to problems among Mormons that have been under-examined by the media. In the case of the investment scam, the greed and gullibility of some Mormon investors, and the use of church angles to defraud. In the case of the murders, the unusually high number of radical apostate Mormons, most of them spurting from the church's right wing, who wreak havoc even among innocent bystanders to their activities. 2 years ago, I gave a speech at BYU to the campus chapter of Sigma Delta Chi about the clash between Mormon morality and journalism ethics. My attempt was to help student journalists prepare for the real world, a world where at times they might have to compromise a Mormon ethic or standard in favor of a lower journalism practice, or, on the other hand, where at times they might have to compromise a lower LDS standard in favor of a higher journalism ethic. And I'll give you an example of each. The Mormon standard involving lying is higher than the journalism standard. The LDS Doctrine and Covenant says it is wrong to lie even if the deception is being used to catch another in a lie. Not so with journalism. Deception is a common tool of reporting. Reporters learn, both through the classroom and through on-the-job experience, how to use deceit in getting information from people or organizations they think are hiding the truth. Interestingly, the journalism standard for presenting information, once it has been gathered, is much higher than the Mormon standard. The journalism ethic is that accounts of events be accurate and fair. Not so in Mormonism. Most LDS writers and speakers pay little attention to accuracy and even less to fairness in their presentations. A Mormon journalist who is also a Sunday school teacher would be out of the mainstream if he used his professional standards in preparing his church lessons. As a journalism instructor, I think there are many areas where professional journalism standards should be raised. Even if deception is not banned outright as a reporting tool, reporters should be slower to use it. I think journalism schools at church-owned universities such as BYU have even a greater obligation for pushing for higher ethical standards. At BYU, President Jeffrey Holland has repeatedly told the faculty he considers the instruction of high ethical standards in all professions to be a priority. I also believe that Mormon teachers and speakers at all levels in the church organization should adopt higher standards of accuracy and balance. I think Mormons in general do need to hone their moral sensitivity and react more sharply to unbecoming ethical conduct. Here's an example. While doing some research, I ran across an allegation that a particular general authority fudged with the truth. One of my sources, who was close to that authority, told me the individual once confided in him that he occasionally made up stories that he used in his conference or church talks. To check that assertion, I picked one of the authority's talks at random, one in which a person's name was used, a name that could be checked to verify the story. A search of church records revealed that the person named in the story, who was supposedly LDS, was not listed as a member. It appears the story may have been made up. There are cases where journalists have made up news stories. The most recent notable example was in 81 when a Pulitzer Prize was awarded to reporter Janet Cook for a news story she had written. Suddenly it was learned that she fabricated her award-winning story. Was a fact not taken lightly by the journalism community. One columnist said Cook cast aside all ethics to get to the top. Dan Rather called the incident a setback for journalism as a profession. The Wall Street Journal chided Cook's paper, the Washington Post, and the Pulitzer Board for being duped by the reporter. The reason for the harsh reaction to the story fabrication lies with a general commitment in the journalism profession to be accurate, to report things as they really are. If a general authority did fabricate a story, I wonder if his peers would react nearly as strongly as did Janet Cook's. A watchful, probing news media can help raise the standards of the institutions they cover. Many Americans believe our government is strengthened, not weakened, by reporters taking politicians to task. I think institutions such as churches can benefit similarly, but it comes back to the philosophies of news judgments I talked about earlier. Does the press have any business looking into a private, non-government organization? Are probing press reports often destructive, so to be avoided or limited whenever possible? Again, the views I expressed this afternoon are likely minority views and do not represent mainstream journalism thought in Utah. For those of you who think religious organizations are somewhat sacred, their leaders should not be treated by the press like common politicians. Worry not. Utah media managers generally agree. Thank you.
we don't have an ideal setup for a panel discussion here, so this is the way we'll handle it. If each of you who has a question or a comment would stand and address it to a specific panel member, then they could be making their way up to the microphone as you ask the question or make the comment. And then we'll ask any of the other the panelists who want to elaborate on that comment or who want to dispute that comment to make their way up here and hurry the speaker along so they can get the microphone. Questions from back there. Paul Richard, do you want to respond first, and then Paul Swenson?
I think Bob's finding out what we know in the church, that it's easier to get forgiven than to get permission. And that is really a truism in many ways. I get aggravated at journalists that come and expect everything hunky-dory. I do that because I know everything isn't just right, and it's going to take some digging. And I don't respect anybody who lies down and doesn't try and then